It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last week, a 21-member task force assembled by Mayor Peduto and charged with examining public education in Pittsburgh issued a report outlining its recommendations for strengthening the city's public schools. As part of WESA's Life of Learning initiative, we're going to discuss the results of that one-year study today. Joining us in Studio A are task force members Carrie Harris, who is executive director of A-Plus Schools. Carrie Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Patrick Dowd, executive director of Allies for Children. He is a former Pittsburgh City Councilman. Patrick Dowd, good to have you with us.
Good to see you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. What recommendations do you think it was important for the task force to consider? Again, our number, 412-246-2002, the number to call. And I'll throw this question out to both of you, Patrick Dowd and Carrie Harris. What are the big takeaways here? What were the most important findings for this task force?
So if you look at the report, probably the most important takeaway from the conversations that the group had over the course of the year were to increase collaboration between the city, the city government, and the Pittsburgh Board of Education or the school district. We really believe that these two governments, when it comes to serving children, have a common objective to make Pittsburgh a great place to raise children and enable them to achieve academic excellence and a promising future. And so the task force really focused on a set of recommendations that it thought would be a way of establishing systemic, intentional, purposeful collaboration now and hopefully into the future, and to eventually envision these governments working as a kind of cohesive system when it comes to children.
When you talk about the city and the district having the same interest here, being educating children, it's almost like when you talk about the United States and England being separated by a common language. The goal is the same, and yet there seems to be a disconnect here. The Pittsburgh School Board positions at one time were appointed. Once that ended, did it lead to less cooperation between the city and the school administration?
Yeah, I don't think that that's necessarily true. It is true that in the mid 70s we moved from a school board that was appointed by the Court of Common Pleas, the judges of Allegheny County, to a by-district elected board. And you do have two governing structures in the city of Pittsburgh, one the school board, one the city council. And we believe essentially that it is possible for those two organizations to work more collaboratively and consistently and, again, systematically on behalf of children. I think there has been some history over the last 15 or so years that has made that difficult. The city was in financial distress. In the early 2000s, there was a redistribution of funding, some money taken from the school district, a significant amount to provide financial relief for the city. And the school district, not as a result of that, but at the same time as that, was making severe cuts and has, quite frankly, continued to do some of that work over time. So I think there has been a history of tensions, but that doesn't mean that it's impossible.
Is it just the financial issues, or is there something more factoring into this?
Well, typically when it comes to government, that's an important issue.
Right. Well, obviously. But are there philosophical differences? Is there something that goes beyond financial?
No, I don't think so. I think those tensions Patrick alluded to have definitely been there, but I'd say sort of the lack of collaboration is really not is unintended, right? It's just a school district trying to educate 26,000 kids under a lot of its own financial pressures, academic pressures, compliance pressures, focused on doing its job. The city also sort of managing its way through financial distress. But I think we just had this moment in time where the mayor and council took some leadership and said, let's find a way to align our ships, tie our prospects together, prospects for a brighter Pittsburgh and a brighter public school system, and figure out what we can do together. So I think as much of it is just, you know, everybody being able to take a deep breath and focus on places that they can help each other.
And I think just to follow up on what Carrie said, she's exactly right. It's unintentional. the lack of collaboration. It's not necessarily that these tensions run so deep that it's impossible to resolve. And another point that's important to consider here is that in the past we have not had mayors that have genuinely cared about the interests of kids. We've had mayors who have had an interest, for example, in school board elections, in part because they cared about tax increment financing and things of that sort. I mean, today we have a mayor who says repeatedly and consistently that he is interested in improving outcomes for kids, and he wants to make sure that we have a strong public school system, and he wants to do what he can to be supportive of that. So that is another important part of the change that's taking place in front of us here in Pittsburgh.
So if funding is one of the major sources of tension between...
It has been, historically.
So if that is... Since that has been established as a cause of tension, how do you solve that? How do you solve the funding problem? What recommendations did the task force have for that? Well, if in fact that is a big problem.
That is not something that we suggest needs to be resolved by a task force. We essentially said, look, it is recognized that there were these changes that were made as far as funding. Both these entities, the school system and the city, are moving forward with financial relief plans and plans to essentially resolve their past histories when it comes to finances. What we propose is, in addition to that work, that these two governments work together systematically to find places where they can collaborate. And essentially, you could think of it as a form of cost sharing, although that was not our intention when we wrote it. But to think about what work can the city do in relation to, for example, public safety to help reduce some of the challenges that students face as they walk into the school building and as they leave the school building each day. And to assist the school district in that way, and hopefully over time to make it less costly for providing education services, for example, to students.
Well, I'm looking at a funding synopsis from the report, and, mm-hmm. and what I'm getting from it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I the sense I get here is that there's some equity issues mm-hmm. that Carrie, what about that?
So, I mean, the other piece that the task force really looked at is, you know, Pennsylvania, hopefully, unfortunately, has not had a funding formula in place for 3 or 4 years now. There is a legislative commission at the state level and some work happening across the state to design a new education funding formula to more equitably distribute state resources for public education across the state. So the recommendation of the task force is really that the district and the city work together as part of this effort to make sure we have a fair and equitable funding system for the whole Commonwealth to be part of that, but also to protect the interests of Pittsburgh Public Schools so that we can continue to have a financially viable going concern as a public school system.
We're talking about a report that was a year in the making that has been issued by Mayor Peduto's Education Task Force, 21 people involved in this. That report came out last week, and we're parsing through it now with Carrie Harris, who is Executive Director of A-Plus Schools. Also with us, Patrick Dowd, Executive Director of Allies for Children. He is a former Pittsburgh City Councilor. Your comments or questions for them are welcome at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Again, the email address, esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. Talk about how the task force went about its research. As you sat down to do this a year ago, what sorts of priorities did you come up with, and what sort of methodology did you devise for putting this report together?
Well, I think it was primarily some very robust discussions among task force members about what should be on our agenda and what shouldn't be.
You kind of gave there was a look in your eye when you said those, talked about the robust discussions. It sounds like it might have been a little heated.
It certainly was at times. I mean, that's not a bad thing. It was good discussion about important topics.
And they just spanned a broad range. I mean, when anytime you talk about schools, it can be intense, and education policy is very complicated, so you could be talking about crossing guards 1 minute and school funding the next. There's a lot to talk about. So we had broad-ranging discussions, and I think, you know, once we agreed that we wanted to focus on sort of actionable, winnable, collaborative ideas, then we started to think of, like, where, you know, the Venn diagram of where the school district and the city overlap, what are the things in there that we could really try to make a difference on?
Why did we need a task force to have these ideas taken seriously?
So a couple things. And in the introduction, you announced that I was a former city councilman. I'm also a former school board member. So I spent a little bit of time on both sides, if you will. And I think that's –
there's so much in your resume, Patrick. It's hard to cover it all.
It's mostly around schools. So anyway, the thing to think about, though, is trying to bring together groups – these different groups. And so we had on the task force, we had members who were from the city council. We had members who were from the school board. The superintendent was a participant regularly. We had community members, advocates like Carrie and other folks. And so it's important to get those people together in a room and try to think from the mayor's perspective, for example. If the mayor campaigns and says he wants to focus on public education, it's important to bring those people together and try to get a sense of the general broad parameters of where that work would go. And then once, for example, a task force has done its work, it's now time to put together a set of working groups that can actually achieve those objectives. So it's important to essentially make sure you're moving in the right direction and that all parties are aligned. And as Carrie said earlier, to make sure that we're sort of rowing in the same direction or steering our boats in the same direction. She is those kinds of things.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Let's go to Margo in Highland Park. Margo, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Carrie Harris and Patrick Dowd. Hello, Margo. Margo's raising her hand, but I can't see her. There she is. All right. There you are. Hi, Margo.
I cut you off.
No, that's okay.
I was calling because, you know, I'm a mom of a 10 and 8-year-old.
That's great.
And it seems like we're working off of, and I understand there are lots of issues in Pittsburgh Public Schools, and we seem to be working off of a model that isn't correct. One of, you know, like generations ago, where moms are at home, where kids are not being neglected, and there's just a lot of problems that seem to be put on the backs of women who are expected to, you know, deal with two-hour delays, deal with teaching their kids at home, deal with single-parent homes. And I don't know how you can go forward with a lot of these things that you're talking about without first addressing how we have changed incredibly, completely from the model that we had 25 years ago. So how do you begin this conversation without looking at the basics of where kids are coming from today that is so different from where they were coming from generations ago?
So, Margo, you're saying there needs to be we need to emphasize the changes that have happened in society, and it sounds like what you're saying is that education, for better or worse, begins at home, and it really comes down to how parents and families handle things?
In a sense, but yeah, education beginning at home, but in fact that does not happen as much as we'd like to think or wish that it could, because the burden is really on women today and what we're expected to do with, you know, the jobs, children, all these things, managing money. It's just not the same. And the fact that when you look at public schools, these are children who maybe are not growing up in the best situations, and we tried public school and had to move to a charter because we were not having any luck. My children had difficult upbringings, and I think we're not starting at where we need to start. So I'd like to hear your two people there address the fact that we're not starting at the right place when we start these discussions.
Well, I'll chime in, if that's okay. Margo, I am feeling your pain as a mother of three school students, public school students, so much about what is expected of us as moms and parents has changed. And I think we're all feeling the pain of two-hour delays. I'm looking at Patrick. He's feeling the pain. School closings, two-hour delays. But honestly, it's minor in comparison to some of the larger issues that you raise. And I think the scope of work for this task force was certainly fairly narrow in terms of places that the city and the district could collaborate. But the issue you're raising is really deep and broad and affects really the way public education is delivered in this country. And the reality is those challenges you're raising are, you know, the whole system across the country has been slow to respond to. right? The economy's not the same as it was 40, 50 years ago. Family life is not the same as it was 40 or 50 years ago. Technology, everything is changing very rapidly, and school systems are frankly just very slow to respond. And response is often met with swift and severe resistance to change. I'm with you. There are so many things that need we need to be thinking about differently. We can't assume anymore that our kids come ready to learn and that they're going home to a mom who doesn't work and that somebody's working with them on their times tables, that they even have a meal to eat. And we can't assume that there is a job in a factory for them when they graduate. In fact, what is required of our kids today is much more significant than what was required of you or I when we graduate, and we expect that that sort of demand is only going to increase. So I'm with you. I think that districts have been slow to respond. I think that's why a lot of folks are moving into charters. But I will say this for Pittsburgh Public. It has, the superintendent has laid out an agenda, the whole child, the whole community, really trying to acknowledge that there's lots of things that the district needs to be worried about. It needs to be accelerating K-12 education, but also needs to be accelerating its ability to address the needs of the whole child that are outside of academics.
Patrick, that area that's your area of the city that you represented it. You live there now. Margot calling from Highland Park. When you hear someone say, as she did, that we tried the public schools, it didn't work. We have our kids in a charter school now.
So the first thing, I'm also a parent of five kids, and Lanny and I have been living in Highland Park for some time, and we have our kids in – all of our kids are in public schools. We have four who are in the Pittsburgh public schools and one who's in a charter. Charters are technically public schools. So what I would like to say, though, I think Margot's point about the need to think more broadly and to think about where we're starting the day, let's say, and where we're ending the day, I think is really important. And Carrie's right, the task force had a narrow focus. But there are some elements in here that hint at a direction forward on some of this. So, for example, when we think about public safety, and I know A-plus Schools is really interested in things like safe routes and areas of that sort, issues of that sort. But when we think about trying to get kids to and from those places where we know that they're going to learn and grow and develop, you know, so moving from the home to these other places, we know that they're going to need safe routes because, as Margot points out, parents aren't going to be able to do everything for their kids, especially as they get older. So we want to find ways to ensure safety for kids as they pass from one place to another inside of the city. Additionally, and I think more directly, the task force urges the mayor to take a more direct role and a more active role in out-of-school time programming. And we know increasingly, to Margot's point, that there are a lot of kids who are participating in these programs, but not everybody, and not everybody can afford them, and they don't have access. And we want to make sure, we encourage the mayor to make sure that he takes a more active role in expanding access and quality. Again, something that A-plus Schools was on the front line of doing when they first started their work.
The task force recommends prioritizing, reducing, and eliminating dangers in zones surrounding schools. Why is more policing the proposed option to address safety?
Well, it's not necessarily more policing as much as more attention to the zones around a school building. So imagine a child walking from, Margot lives in Highland Park, from Highland Park to Obama to attend the academy there. And there could be safety hazards, abandoned cars, issues related to blighted and abandoned property. This would happen in lots of neighborhoods in our city. And so we want to make sure we urge the mayor and his public safety officials, whether it's the police or building inspection or others, to take a more active role in guaranteeing that those areas immediately surrounding, those zones immediately surrounding schools, that they are actually as safe as possible.
One of the recommendations that really jumps out is for public safety employees, the city and the district to work together, ensuring minor school infractions do not result in filing charges. How did we get to this point where this has been happening?
Well, we didn't get there alone. I think it's again another problem that's been happening throughout the country, but what we definitely see is that schools like our criminal justice system had started implementing zero tolerance policies, whereas, you know, with the, I think, intention of we're going to manage behavior, but the unintended consequence is that it turns out to push kids out of school, decrease their attendance, greatly increase the risk that they won't graduate, and increase the risk that they end up incarcerated later. So acknowledging that we want the school system to deal with these disciplinary policies inside the system, but the school police and the district police to realize that criminalizing mischievous behavior on the part of kids is not going to get us better outcomes. It's not going to make the city more prosperous, and it's not going to give our kids a brighter future.
Let's go to Judy in Pittsburgh. Judy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello.
You have a suggestion.
I was calling to suggest that instead of policing and protecting these kids home to school and back again, that these empty schools that the board is responsible for all across the city be opened up and used as after-school facilities for helping these kids with their homework, but not just that, but be a recreational area where these kids can go and be off the streets and wait for their parents to come home from work, or, you know, even if they are home, if they're not responsible parents, but to keep these kids out of trouble. These schools are all standing empty, and, you know, unless some contractor buys them up for high rises for seniors, they're just standing empty. Let the kids have these facilities. We used to have rec centers everywhere.
Judy, I think that the recommendation that you're making is really very much aligned with what we were saying to the mayor. Maybe not exactly utilizing the closed school buildings, although that's something that certainly could be examined. But the idea of providing access to quality after-school and out-of-school time programming for kids, whether it's for homework and focus on scholastic work, or it's recreation, opportunities for kids to engage in good, meaningful behavior and activities after school.
And obviously it takes money to do that, so...
Well, and here's why it's important exactly for having someone like a city, a municipal leader in the form of a mayor and the superintendent aligned on the same page and thinking about these things. You know, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is up for reauthorization this year, and there's a real chance that one of the only sources of federally funded programming is going to be radically changed, if not cut, and could have serious impacts for school districts across the country, including Pittsburgh. And so it's important for mayors and superintendents to be aligned and to be advocating vociferously and collectively and cohesively with federal and state officials to make sure, in that case, that that legislation doesn't negatively impact Pittsburgh, and the school funding formula that Carrie's talking about, that doesn't negatively affect our district. So that's another important reason for this collaboration and another direction that I think is hinted at in this report.
Let's take one last call from Ted in Mount Washington. Ted, welcome. We're a little short on time, so if you can go quickly, we would appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you for your guests. I think they'll bring up some great points. But my point is there needs to be more oversight on charter schools. If you measure the performance of charter schools, they don't even perform at a standard rate. If you read Mr. Jack Wagner, when he's the attorney general, he was saying that the money that's being spent on charter schools need oversight. If you look at the embezzlement by, the CEO that was embezzling money, that's taxpayers' money, and I wish that your report had that in it.
Thanks. Thank you for that comment, and I would agree with you with regard to oversight of charters and, quite frankly, all schools and all institutions that use taxpayer dollars. I think charters play an interesting role in the school system here in Pittsburgh and across the Commonwealth and country, and I think we want to make sure that we hold them to a same standard, not higher, not lower, than the public school system in which, you know, kids attend here in Pittsburgh and elsewhere.
And I would just offer, Ted, I think a lot of what Jack Wagner found was had to do with cyber charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
In Pittsburgh, we happen to be lucky to benefit from some really strong charter schools that are not cyber charter schools, but brick-and-mortar schools. They're run by former PPS teachers and administrators, mm-hmm. and they're doing a great job with kids. They're getting great results, and many of our charters are actually closing the achievement gap. So we have to be mindful that we need to learn from those charters. We need to hold every school accountable, and we need to celebrate success where it's happening in any public school.
Carrie Harris is Executive Director of A-Plus Schools. We've also been talking with Patrick Dowd, Executive Director of Allies for Children. Thanks to both of you for joining us and sharing some of the details in the Mayor's Task Force Report on Public Education in Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll meet a 95-year-old World War II veteran from Pittsburgh whose heroics saved the lives of Allied soldiers. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 70 years ago this month, February 1945, the Allied armies were making their way into the heart of the Third Reich, Nazi Germany, in the closing months of World War II. 25-year-old George Petropola was a 1st Division radio operator battling the bitter cold in the Ardennes Forest on the banks of the Ruhr River, which flows through Belgium, Germany, and the Netherlands. In addition to the challenge of surviving the severe winter weather, Mr. Petropola found himself in an area that was heavily mined. Today, at the age of 95, this longtime resident of Penn Hills and Monroeville lives with his son and daughter-in-law in Cranberry, and he joins us today on Essential Pittsburgh. George Petropola, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
What do you remember, first of all, about the cold of the Ardennes Forest?
Very cold. Very cold. That's all I can say. It was so cold that I didn't know where to go, how to keep warm.
Talk about being on the banks of the river, being in the Ardennes. You could see the Germans on the other side of the river, couldn't you?
Yes, I could. Yes. That's all I can remember. It wasn't very wide of a river. You could look right across and see them on the other side of the river.
You were presented with a Bronze Star for heroism under fire from February 9th to February 24th, 1945. Those must have been very trying days.
Yes, they were. That was along the Ruhr River in Germany. It was a special mission that they would send me on, and very dangerous. Heavily mined, a lot of enemy firing going on, and it was one of the critical places, Ruhr River.
General Simpson's Ninth Army GIs buckle on life belts as they get ready for the hazardous job of bridging the fast-flowing River Ruhr, the biggest natural obstacle barring the way to the Rhine. An unusually short and intense barrage, it lasted only 3/4 hour, swept the assault area with unprecedented thoroughness. All roads to the Ruhr River lead through ruins.
This was in the last months of the war in Europe, at least.
Yeah.
Describe what that was like. You're making this headway, you're into Germany, but it still must have seemed like you were so close and yet so far from the end of it all.
Yes, it was. It seemed like it, but it really wasn't. There was still a lot of firing going on all the time, and it never let up. Finally, we broke through, and that was the end of it. And I was appointed to go to Berlin to meet the Russians. And I sold all our cognac that I had picked up along the way and sold it to the Russians. And in fact, I lost all the money coming home from the service. And a boat.
Well, now, first of all, how much did you make selling the cognac to the Russians?
$4,000 or $5,000, Allied money, which was good money.
And then you said you lost it on the way home. What happened?
Yeah. Well, after the war ended, I was put in one of the groups for the high points system to fly home. But there was some problems there with the airlines, and they asked me if I wanted to take a boat instead of waiting a couple of weeks. And I said, yes, and I'd come home in a boat.
And that's unfortunately where you lost the money.
Yes, I did.
We're talking with George Pietropola, who is a World War II veteran who fought with the 9th Army and also the 1st Army in Germany in the months leading up to the end of the war and some critical battles in February, during February 9th to the 24th, for which he was presented a Bronze Star for heroism. When you received this decoration, and it came right at the end of the war, what was that like? Describe the ceremony and who showed up.
I got the Bronze Star before the war ended. General McLean awarded me the Bronze Star. I didn't even know I was getting anything for it.
And how did it feel? What did it mean to get
that? It felt good. It felt real good. I felt at least I did something.
So the information that you were communicating, was it troop movements? What all was in that?
Communication was they were going to flood out this dam along the Roy River. They were going to blow up the dam, and we kept communications of how it was going and what they were doing at that time.
So by doing that, by communicating that information, you probably saved a lot of lives.
I would think so. I never knew that. I never knew. I never realized it. I just did my job.
Without expressing definite optimism, Allied leaders say the final curtain is about to fall on the European war. Two of our armies have driven into the Saar as the Russians battle just a few miles east of Berlin. The crossing of the Rhine has spelled the doom of Nazi hopes of victory. The crossing of the Ruhr River was a preliminary step before we assaulted the Rhine at Remagen and crossed that river for the first invasion of Germany at this point since 1805.
And I want to talk a little bit about what you did before you got into the Army. You grew up in East Liberty. Describe your days at Westinghouse. I understand you played football there.
Played football, yeah. In fact, I was playing soccer before that. The soccer coach got me on the football team.
How did that happen?
I don't know. I guess I was pretty good playing soccer, so he thought I could make a good football player.
Did you score a lot of touchdowns?
I didn't play too much. And I was only there for my junior and sophomore year. In fact, that after that, I had to leave school.
Right, you dropped out in 11th grade. What happened there?
I come from a large family, and my dad kind of got hurt working, and I had to quit to find a job to help the family, support the family. I ended up laboring for a contractor.
And then how did you end up in the Army?
Drafted under bad conditions. I was drafted with hurting my knees playing football. They just took me anyway.
Were you unsure that maybe you even wanted to go?
I didn't want to go, to be honest with you. No, not under the conditions. I think that was the reason they sent me to radio school. I don't think I was even qualified to go to radio school. Because I was injured, I would think that they send me there because of that. That's what I always had in my mind, just to get me out of the way of any rough because of my knees.
So in a way, the football injury might have been a break for you.
Yes, it was, yeah.
Saved your life.
Same, I would say so, yes.
Then on the fifth day of June 1944, just as you see them here, a fleet of more than 4,000 ships put out from England. This was D-Day, fourth anniversary of the Battle of Dunkirk, and the Allied armies were striking back.
You were also part of the D-Day invasion. What can you tell us about that? Apparently, you were one of the guys that stormed the beach in Normandy under a heavy rain. What all was going on that day?
Well, we was in Southampton training. Finally got in a boat and out to the English Channel. And they finally told me when I got on the boat that we were going to hit the beach in the third wave.
And what was it like when you hit the shore? What did you see?
A lot of injured. Young injury. Looked like young kids. Looked like 15, 16 years old, but they were 19, 20, I guess. But they looked like they were real young and didn't get a chance to raise their guns, most of them. It was more like a slaughter to me. was terrible. That was one of the worst things I've ever seen. It never happened all the time I was in the war.
And were you setting up radio communications there as well?
Yes, I had just a walkie-talkie, and all I carried was a sidearm. And the walkie-talkie, I was supposed to communicate with the 1st Infantry Division, but I never did get any communications. Never did get any calls. I lost communications altogether.
Is it important for you, in a sense, that the stories are told so that people understand a little more about what your generation, the greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw called it, went through during the war?
Yes, I think so. I think they deserve anything they get, the veterans that went through that. Whatever they give to the veterans that fought that war, never enough. You couldn't imagine how terrible things like that could be.
Thank you so much for your service to our country and for talking with us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
You're quite welcome. I appreciate it. It was nice. Nice doing it. Yeah, I'm just glad I came out of it.
We are too. We are too. And we will have a link on our website, wesa.fm. You can see some photos of the decorations, the Bronze Star that George Pietropoulos received. Again, that's at our website, wesa.fm. Coming up, more Essential Pittsburgh. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
When you see him, stop and think. Do not smell, do not drink, do not...
The green, sort of scary, ugly-looking guy sticking his tongue out and sort of scowling at you.
That's Mr. Yuck. Well, the description is Dr. Michael Lynch is doing the talking. He's medical director for the Pittsburgh Poison Center, which developed concurrently with Mr. Yuck to prevent and address poison exposures in the late 60s and early 70s. At that time, the driving force behind Mr. Yuck, Dr. Richard Moriarty, was training in pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh of UPMC. He was bothered by the way the hospital handled poison exposures.
When the phone rang, whoever was the house officer in the emergency room and answered the phone was suddenly the poison person. And often we didn't really know what the heck we were doing. I hate to say that, but that was true.
To improve the hospital's poison response, Moriarty began to organize its resources and identify knowledge gaps. As he did so, he discovered another problem.
The traditional warning symbol for poison was the skull and crossbones. Well, we live in a town that happens to have the Pirates. Traditional warning color for poisons was red. Well, kids sort of like red things.
To develop a new symbol, Moriarty and a team enlisted the help of a focus group.
So we sat down and talked with preschoolers and said, okay, if you got into a poison, what would happen? And the recurring thoughts were, well, you die, you get sick, or your mother would yell at you.
A graphic artist created a series of symbols in a range of colors and put them back in front of the preschoolers.
One of the kids said, that looks yucky. So we thought, okay, well, we got a symbol, we got a name. Let's go with it. But every Yuck sticker that was ever printed carried the phone number of a poison center because we never claimed that Mr. Yuck was going to be the great cure-all for poisoning. And so if a kid got into something or a dog got into something or an adult got into something, they had a place to turn to for help.
Pittsburgh Poison Center, how can I help you?
While poison exposures and poisoning is still the leading cause of accidental death in the United States, it is a relative field that most primary practitioners don't have as much knowledge about.
Though child fatalities from medicines and household cleaners have decreased since 1972, children accounted for more than 1 million poison exposures in 2013. Despite the dangers presented by the thousands of chemicals found in everyday life, the Poison Center has endured steep state and federal funding cuts in recent years.
The last thing we could ever do is start to take away our ability to be able to immediately respond to those calls and questions and emergencies.
So they've scaled back on outreach. But Lynch is determined to find a way to reinvigorate the center's public service campaigns.
In medicine, the best treatment of any disease is the prevention of it. We're going to continue to explore different ways of expanding our primary prevention and education programs within the constraints of our ongoing budget cuts.
Since most exposures don't require a trip to the emergency room, the center annually saves $16 million in healthcare costs by preventing needless ambulance rides and hospital visits. Beyond providing practical information to callers, the Poison Center also provides peace of mind, says Lynch.
A large part of our role is to provide that reassurance. What we are able to do is put you in immediate contact with a live human being and respond to your specific individualized emergency.
While it's difficult to quantify how many fatalities Mr. Yuck and the Poison Center have prevented, providing knowledgeable backup to the community is the point, says Moriarty.
The real payoff is, did you change something? And hopefully for better. And if you did, boy, you're lucky.
For 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. I'm Margaret J. Krause.
90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh is supported by UPMC. Ask your Pittsburgh history question and find more stories online at wesa.fm/inventingpittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Stopping smoking ranks high on the list of personal changes people hope to make. Despite the Surgeon General's warning, many people continue to smoke. In recent years, there's been a rise in e-cigarettes and other products designed to kick the habit. Tough workplace restrictions are being put into effect. Here to take a look at the business of smoking is our contributor, Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. And Rebecca, this might just as well be about the business of non-smoking as it is about, or quitting smoking as it is about smoking.
Right. It's all of the above, really, Paul, because we're looking at both the products that are marketed as traditional cigarette or smoking products. Then we're also looking at the whole cessation market. We're also looking at all the companies that have products on the market to help people stop. So it's a pretty comprehensive business market.
And there are a lot of smokers right here in Pittsburgh.
There certainly are
per
a lot
capita.
Of, yeah, there really are. Now, in terms of nationally, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention gave us stats as of November 2014, the portion of adults who smoke was 17% in 2013. So they had done it from the year before. And that was the lowest level since 1964. And that's when the Surgeon General's report came out basically saying that the effects of cigarettes are really deadly, as we now know. And smoking has really fallen in popularity since 1965. At that time, 52% of all men and 34% of all women regularly smoked, Paul. And now it's down to 20% of all men and 15% of women smoke. And in Pennsylvania, though, our numbers are higher than we would like to see. And we're just looking at adults, Paul. I don't have statistics on children, although we certainly do see kids smoking, and that's
take
just
a walk down Carson Street.
Oh, boy. I just don't like to see it at all because we know that it's such a hard habit to kick. But for adults ages 18 and over, 24% of the adults ages 18 and over, 22% smoke, and that was from a 2011 study, and that's in Pennsylvania. And the range for all states is 11% to 29%. So we're ranked at like 33 among the states, so we could do a lot better.
And there, I don't know if this is really the time or place to address what keeps people smoking, but one thing we do know from a business standpoint is that cigarette manufacturers are still looking at ways to market their product, which is limited. It was 1970 that they made it illegal to advertise cigarettes on television and radio. What about in print? Are we still seeing ads in places?
I think that we're still seeing them in print. And certainly when you go to the movies and you see them virtually portrayed in lots of different imagery now, I think it's still very prevalent in our modern day imagery. And I still
Is
think
it? I mean, years ago it was. It was thought of as romantic and sophisticated. But is that image still being perpetrated now in mass
certainly,
media?
I certainly, if you look at some of the movies that have been out lately, I see less smoking than I used to, but certainly it still is prevalent. And I think And we know from the numbers, approximately 44 million adults smoke. That's such a huge number, Paul. And that's adults. We don't even know under the underage smoking. And I think when you think about then the secondary effect of cigarette smoke, we know that a number of people can develop health problems who don't even smoke. It leads to even more health problems from there. In 2008, the Clean Indoor Air Act was passed, and that really prohibited smoking in a public place or in the workplace, which was a huge step forward in terms of really protecting both those who smoke sort of from themselves and protecting those who don't smoke. And in September of 2008, it was very comprehensive. All of Pennsylvania was 100% smoke-free in non-hospitality. But still, Paul, in casinos, in certain areas and bars, and certain enclosed areas and restaurants, smoking is still allowed. So there's not a lot we could do about that.
So is there an equal amount of effort to market products to help people kick the habit of smoking as there are the efforts to encourage people to smoke? Has the effort, the anti-smoking effort, or the effort to supply people with products that might help them quit smoking, has that exceeded now?
Well,
the other push?
Yeah, when you see, and there's certainly, we always talk about following the money. So there certainly is money in the, what is it called, the NRT, which is the nicotine replacement therapy market, Paul. And that is definitely a very powerful market. And we also see that very prevalent in what some businesses are doing. For example, Macy's and Pepsi have basically been charging smokers who are their employees a higher surcharge on their health insurance. And when a 2014 study, and we have a number of these listed on your website, of large and mid-sized employers looked at, there are now incentives that employers are giving for non-tobacco use and surcharges on smokers. And a number of companies are banning smoking from not only inside their offices but on their campuses. And so when that happens, that kicks into effect and impacts the amount and the need for the nicotine replacement therapy products. So I think that's very important.
What kind of due diligence do people need to do to make sure they're buying something that works?
Well, and I think works is a pretty relative term, because what does work? Now, here's what CVS did. CVS last year dropped selling tobacco products in their market, which was really interesting. And they renamed their corporate name CVS Health. And so they said it really conflicted with their healthcare mission. Now, they still sell a lot of these products, such as things like all the replacement therapies are considered things like nicotine replacement. There's lozenges, there's patches, there's sprays, there's inhalers, and then there's even electronic cigarettes.
Right, and we have a question from Nettie on Twitter. She says, speaking of Carson Street, what are your thoughts on all the vape shops popping up?
That gets back to the, sort of the electronic cigarette question.
Which,
too,
again, the research is not necessarily indicating that that's any safer or that it is safe.
That's exactly right. And I think what we're seeing now is electronic cigarettes is the largest and the fastest growing segment in the smoking cessation market. And 80% of the e-cigarette market share lies in Europe and in North America. And the regulations of e-cigarettes as medical devices is really still in debate. And it's a problem. We really don't know what the long-term side effect is of e-cigarettes. So what we want you to do is stop smoking.
That is some good advice from Rebecca Harris. She's director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship and our business contributor. And again, that business, the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship is at Chatham University.
Yes.
Make sure to get that in there. Thank you, Rebecca.
It's a pleasure, Paul.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, despite safety improvements, we are seeing an alarming number of fuel train accidents. What safety improvements are needed? What is the plan if such an accident were to occur in Pittsburgh? That is tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening.